Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 4th, 2001, and in the fireside room this afternoon is a forum titled America, Privileges and Responsibilities. The tape number is FO2001-5.
I come from the center of the universe, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I've been asked to be a moderator. I've never done this before. And but I have what I understand to be four distinguished panelists. And I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves to you. What we're going to do is start with an introduction and then spend a couple minutes with the individual perspectives on the title of the forum, which is America, Privileges and Responsibilities. That's the title of the forum. And then after that, we'll just simply open it up to conversation, and we will be ending at 4 o'clock?
Probably.
4 o'clock, because the line starts, or the dinner starts at 4:15. All right, and then I think that what I was supposed to do is have an egg timer or something like that, but I think that I will just kind of, if people have a lot to say, I may kind of say, let's move on, but you never know what I'll do. So why don't we start on this end and introduce yourself, and then why don't you start with your opening statement, and then we'll go through that.
All right, I'm Norm Moline. I teach geography at Rogers Stanley College in Rock Island, Illinois. And somehow among the teaching staff, they said I should be one who's on this panel along with Kathy. I wrote down a few thoughts since I knew our time was short. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women are created equal with certain inalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We all know those lines. Today it is fun to celebrate what citizens did 225 years ago. They took a radical stand to declare the importance of a concept and fought to achieve it, and were lucky enough to be successful. We also celebrate what's happened in these 225 years, and here we can be thankful for sort of the good environment we had to start here that has given us certain opportunities that we've used, sometimes wisely, sometimes not, but we're lucky we have that and we can celebrate that today. Fortunate to have been able to create a prosperous economy to allow a high percentage of people to live a good life with good food, good shelter, good health care, good income, many other amenities. The fact that we're able to spend a week here doing this kind of thing rather than cutting corn or cutting trees or something else itself testifies to that privilege. Of course, our religious freedom and freedom of expression. Also, our diversity, despite some failures and prejudices and inequalities and injustices which still survive, America is diverse, and the ability of many people from different cultures, nations, and continents to come here and live and work and raise families and more or less get along peacefully most of the time, I think is incredible, particularly when seen in a global perspective when we think of places such as Yugoslavia and the former USSR, Sudan, Ireland, we go on the list. Ifu Tuan, a geographer at the University of Wisconsin, said every culture needs to be somewhat ethnocentric, needs to believe its culture is good, valuable, important, central, number one. Today, you, I celebrate our good feelings that our culture is valuable, good, important, and at least in our minds, number one. Yet with freedoms and celebrations come qualifications and responsibilities. One person's, one group's, one nation's freedoms often come at the expense of someone else or some other group. I doubt if many Americans are celebrating this day. Native Americans are celebrating today. Sometimes our freedoms come at the expense of some other group. One state's freedom to use its water takes that water from others. And here, there's a funny story. In southern Utah, we stopped a few years ago. They asked me to fill out a survey. They were having me fixing a golf course. They already have one. They're going to put another one out. I don't particularly like golf. So I told them that. They said, fill the form out anyway. And then I said, I really don't think you ought to build another golf course here because water's short. And I know Arizona doesn't have as much water, and they need your water. And the woman said, the hell with Arizona. So that's an example. Your one state's freedoms to use may impact on others. Those with the freedom and power to move a corporation, to move a productive activity, take away from the economic freedom of the many local people who work in the factories. A landowner who exercises his or her freedom to use his or her land the way he or she wishes may infringe on the quality of life of a neighbor and prevent that person from using the land the way he or she wishes to do that. A nation, in carrying out its beliefs and its importance and centrality, may take away the options of other cultures to live out their way of life, to exercise their ethnocentrism. That is, in striving to be important, to be number one, we may take away the rights of others to be number one, too. So as we celebrate our freedom, the topic of the day, I think our task is to remember the initial premise or value system of what this nation was or is about. That is, all men and women are created equal, and that's both here and abroad, and deserve basic freedoms. And thus we have responsibilities, one, to try to protect and enhance others' freedoms as we enjoy our own. Two, to use our lands in sustainable ways so that we do not take away the economic freedom of our children and grandchildren. Three, to recognize the rights of other nations, to celebrate their identities, to let them be as proud of their culture as it is, as we might be of ours, without trying to change them to be like us. And last, to try to correct those situations within our own culture where freedoms have been taken away.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ben Stewart. I'm the village pastor here. Been here since mid-October this past year. And I'll kind of be the God guy in the introductory part. Recognizing that that heaven is a international place. There's an old joke that says, you know, in heaven, the British will be in charge of the police, the Italians will be in charge of romance, the French will be in charge of the food, and the Germans will be in charge of the organization. And the flip side is in hell, the British are in charge of the food, the Italians are in charge of the police, the French are in charge of the organization, and the Germans are in charge of romance. Good joke. I think there's a spiritual insight in this, though, that most religious traditions touch on. I think Christianity and Judaism both do a good job of that also. And that's one example of it is Jesus' temptation. It's this kind of picture of Jesus out in the wilderness, and as the Satan, as the deceiver comes to tempt him, he doesn't try to bash him down and make Jesus this weak nothing. He's trying to build him up, you know, play to his strengths. You know, I'll give you power, I'll give you glory. Use your faith to jump off this Temple Mount. Let's do some miraculous miracles. And I think it points up the fact that sometimes our greatest strength, like Germans and organization, can have this shadow side that can become its most awful temptation. Organize our love life, you know, and not allow any passion in there. You know, organize our society in such a way so we're going to chuck these Jewish people out of here. So I think as I think about privileges and responsibilities for the U.S., to play with this business of, what is this nation's calling to our privileges and responsibilities, and where's the shadow side there? You know, if we've got a great strength to do freedom and we've got great wealth, where's the shadow side? I guess if I would take a leap here, first of all, I just one example of this that I encountered just before I left for Holden. I lived in a farming community in Ohio. The United States produces more food than we ever need. I mean, we pay our farmers not to produce it. We pay a price for that. Our family was taking a walk in our neighborhood park, and suddenly we came upon the creek, beautiful creek, and there were just thousands of dead fish floating down it. We found out 2 days later that the big fertilizer thing that supplied everybody around us had been leaking into the creek and killed over 10,000 fish like that. It's now a dead zone that they say will take 5 to 10 years to recover. Just like that, the same stuff that gives us so much food and we can feed people with is also this terrible shadow side. So I guess as I think about the calling of the U.S., I think about our great wealth that we can share with the poor in our country and we can share with the world. The shadow side, I think, can be being paternalistic about it and making it, you know, them somehow dependent on us. But I think that's our privilege right now to have great wealth and to have great food. But our responsibility is to share it with the world in a mutually respectable way.
Thank you very much.
My name is Kathy Anderson. I'm on the teaching staff here at Holden, and in San Diego, I'm the executive director of Survivors of Torture International, and I too wrote down some of my thoughts. When I think about the 4th of July, my thoughts immediately turn to how the U.S. is a nation of immigrants and how we are a generous people who extend the gift of hospitality to others in need of refuge and hope. Most of the people I've met who have come here to the United States have been very grateful to the United States and the freedoms it offers. Also, many of them say they wish that they never had to have left their countries of origin, their familiar homes, their customs, their foods, their extended families. Many leave their countries out of necessity, economic, political, and religious reasons. Of course, and I have to ask myself, what are the forces that make these people have to leave their beloved countries? And there are many reasons, but one of them is right here in the U.S. and is called the School of America. And recently it changed its name and its curriculum, but truly it still is the School of America. And I want to tell you a little bit about it. And for some of you, you probably already know about School of America. let's see. School of America is an instruction center set up in 1946 by the U.S. authorities to train Latin American military personnel. This sadly celebrated establishment has acquired the alternative name School of the Assassins. Thanks to its role in imparting techniques of repression and torture, among its graduates are the Bolivian dictator Hugo Banzer, Manuel Noriega, and numerous military officers, including those responsible for the murder of Archbishop Oscar Romero in 1989. In 1996 and 1997, the U.S. Defense Secretary was obliged to make public 7 manuals containing material in flagrant breach of democratic principles and human rights, which had been used in the courses. These revelations did not lead to any charges against individuals or any moves to punish the authors or those who had taught these practices. Today, this establishment still instructs about 1,000 military personnel each year, many of them from Mexico. It is financed from the U.S. defense budget. I believe that we should call for to denounce the existence of an institution in which torture has been legitimized and recognized as a means of government, to declare unequivocally that the teaching of torture is totally unacceptable, whatever the reasons and circumstances involved. So I'll tell you a little bit about the organization of the School of America's Watch. This organization, created on the initiative of a U.S. Catholic priest, Roy, and I'm going to kill this name, Bourgeois, is a U.S.-based association which cooperates with a wider network of organizations dedicated to the cause. While living in Bolivia in the 1970s, Roy B. witnessed numerous cases of torture. He was present as an observer at the moment of the assassination of Archbishop Romero and 4 U.S. nuns, 2 of whom were close friends of his. His investigations into the cause of these crimes led to the discovery that the soldiers involved had passed through the School of Americas. Little by little, he pieced together the cause and effect relationship linking the military instruction imparted there to certain major human rights violations. At that moment, he vowed that he would work to get that establishment closed down. For that purpose, he founded School of America's Watch, which commemorated its 10th birthday in the year 2000. So in closing, indeed, in the U.S., we have freedom, but with it comes both responsibility and the necessity to hold ourselves accountable. And I don't have my Bible with me, but we were reading a passage from Hebrews 13:2. Rebecca, can you help me?
No, I'm not going to be able to remember it.
Put you on the spot.
One more.
Would that be helpful?
Very.
Thanks. I just thought it so beautiful to close this. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Glenn. Well, I'm Glenn Belsett from Minneapolis, and they announced at lunch the other day if any World War II vets were here, and I just have to say yes, so here I am. And I didn't have the topic until I came to the vote this evening, so I thought I would just give a few highlights about my military experience. And I'm a farm boy from western Minnesota, retired as a rural letter carrier, and here I am in Holton Village. And I enlisted in November of 1940. And was inducted into the Federal Service February 10th, 1941. So Pearl Harbor Day, I was walking guard in the PX at Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. And I don't know if any of you studied the history about what they call the Great, practicing anyway, down in Louisiana where they used stovepipes in the lake. But the day of Pearl Harbor, before we had supper that evening, we had our guns and our ammunition and everything and was fully prepared for the war. And I trained in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana, and then we went up to Dix and went overseas to North Ireland. And we stayed in North Ireland for 6 months. And then we had special training, just 32 of my company, which was Company M, 135th Infantry of the 34th Division. And you might say it was commando training. And we went on a little destroyer, two destroyers, the Malcolm and the Broke, which their mission was to go directly into the harbor at Algiers, North Africa. So I was one of them selected out of 10 that went on this little destroyer, and we went through the Straits of Gibraltar, got off at Gibraltar two different times, and then we sailed down under the British flag. And then after dark that evening, they transferred other troops from a bigger cruiser onto our little destroyer, and after dark, they raised the American flag. Well, we were the initial people to go into the harbor of Algiers. And I'll never forget the spotlight hitting that American flag on that ship, and it was just waving gently. And then all hell broke loose with the shore batteries, and we never did get in. The Broke did get in, and they had to leave with half of their men stranded on the dock. And then we went through the whole African campaign, and then we had a little break, and then we went across the Mediterranean and landed on Salerno in Italy, and fought up through the Italian campaign, and the German forces surrendered to our division headquarters in the Po Valley, the 34th Division. And I served 4 years in the service and 2 years overseas. And I guess under that title, the privilege was a free trip with a gun and the responsibility was to use the gun.
How old were you when you enlisted?
You had to be 21 at that time.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. We have 25 minutes about to just kind of reflect on what these folks have presented, your own personal views, a couple things that were brought up. We're all created equal with basic freedoms. I like what you said. Our responsibility is to protect and enhance others' freedoms. And I also heard about there's a shadow side to greatness. And I think that's an interesting concept. The country of immigrants was stressed for us as well. And I think sometimes we forget that, the older immigrants, how new some of our immigrants are and the tragic circumstances from which they come. And the freedom and the accountability, but also, Glenn, what you brought up, your responsibility at a young age for a very frightening time, I would imagine, for you.
Very frightening.
Yeah. Let's open it up out here for anyone who would like to participate. Yes?
I think Norm's the guy I address this to, but do you know anything about the, generally, across the United States, the water tables, are they falling? The big reservoirs, the aquifers that are under water, and how that, if they are, how that is going to affect when Minnesota's drops, does Iowa? I'm just trying to get the interconnectedness of the water supply.
It varies in different parts of the country. The rate of decline is not as much in the central plains as it was. In some places, luckily, it's going up, but in most places, it continues to drop. More places, it is dropping than it is going up. And that means that it comes up, I guess, to one of the points that I made. We use these resources where we're using them faster than what they are going back. It becomes a freedom question because we're using our freedom now to use them because they're there, but we're taking away the freedom from our grandkids to have as easy access to the same resources. And that becomes a generational thing that increasingly is being talked about within the resource management field, not just how we manage it wisely among states and among people now, but what's this going to be like in 50 or even 80 years? I mean, one figure, then be quiet on this, it's surprising. We don't think the United States is growing very rapidly, and we're not comparing to some parts of the world. We have 270 million now, and in 50 years, we're going to have 404. Mm. And I know that strikes it from staggering kind of figure. What's it going to be like to go to Yellowstone and to Yosemite or to Chicago or New York or LA when we have 50% more people than we currently have? So anything that we do with resources now, I think, is taking away from the freedom of future generations.
Anyone else? Please.
It's interesting that the shift in healthcare and our emphasis on older generations, the United States is getting older. So our responsibilities now is kind of shifting towards the older generations and taking care of healthcare. And I was going to say, get back to you on that.
Well, I think to build on that is that I don't want to be too cynical. Baby boomers are aging. Mm-hmm. Baby boomers have tended to take good care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And that may have a bit to play in that. But the health care is very important to talk about, not only the ones who are being served and paying a lot for their premiums, but also the uninsured. And those are the working poor who really have no health insurance, because that's the last thing they want to pay their premiums for. They have to pay their food bills and their rent. Let me ask a question here, and you can respond if you want or not. There are many people I know that don't really sense that there's much responsibility in our lives as Americans. the privileges, indeed the entitlement attitude is there. But I don't hear much talk about responsibilities, frankly, in some of the circles I am privileged to be with. What do you think? Are there inherent responsibilities? We've heard people here say, yes, we are responsible. Where does that come from, and what does that mean to us? Yes, please.
I'd like to hear some ideas about the best way to, I mean, as a young person, or I guess any age, I don't know, the best way to, there's a lot of talk about serving, you know, spreading everything around, you know, because we have a lot and we want to help others who don't have as much. What are some good ways to do that? How can you, like, what kind of a, I guess there's a lot of opportunity out there. Maybe just some ideas about how you go about doing this, actually, you know? Maybe there's so many opportunities that it's kind of makes you stop and pause a minute, but, or maybe, I don't know, I'm just not sure, but like concrete.
If you want to be involved, how do you get involved?
Yeah, what are some good ways to actually make a difference? And I think a lot of people I talk to worry about so much about, like, changing the world, you know, like, they feel like they gotta, like, change the fact that there's huge corporations, like, you know, exploiting massive amount, you know, numbers of people or something, and that just like beats you before you even start, you know. So like, what kind of scale and what are some concrete ways people can get, can actually?
Good question. Ben, did you?
The Lakeland Lutheran, just this past fall, did something really interesting. They went down to Nicaragua on what they called a reverse missionary trip, where they did a few kind of traditional service projects, but mostly just kind of sat at the feet of people in the outlying rural areas of Nicaragua and talked about how U.S. policy affects, or learned how U.S. policy affects farmers in this rural area. And the entire idea was that we have a lot to learn from the way our society, about the way our society affects the rest of the world. And so they came back kind of sent as missionaries back to the United States. You know, as interconnected as we are, we're awfully ignorant about what's happening and how our actions affect the rest of the world. I found that to be really interesting. And I spent some time doing human rights work during college, and you know, it was on an internship and I was doing work, but what I learned most of all was about how our aid policies in the United States really are actually totally about taking money out of the Caribbean economy, at least in the area where I studied. So I think that's a pretty interesting thing, is that instead of Americans going in as the ugly American to solve everything, it's a different pattern that I heard at Lake Chelan. You know, this, we're going to open our ears and listen.
I think what's really exciting is this reverse missionary thing. I mean, I live in Redmond, Washington, so we have the extremes of software gold rush, and then we have an incredible diverse Asian, Hispanic, Slavic, you name it. So churches, you know, that's where you can start. Churches, examples of congregations. I mean, what other kind of buildings, except government buildings, can afford to only be used 30% of the time? You know, so hey, two congregations. You know, here's a Caucasian congregation. Here's Hispanic congregation sharing the same space. They can have some of their own services, but they're doing a joint program. Just one example, the Episcopal Church doing a combination, predominantly Caucasian, predominantly Chinese American congregation, doing a summer program together, so that, you know, Mandarin is taught, English is taught, Bible stories are taught from Caucasian American Chinese, different perspectives seeing the gospel. So we can start with our churches, and many churches are very underutilized in terms of physical resource and people resource.
Yes, I've been on that trip to Nicaragua, and I was the only farmer in the group. And one instance was they wanted to preserve their water, but they didn't know how to do it. They had plenty of help, they had plenty of dirt, so they dammed it up every time. But when the spring rains came, I washed it off. And so we gave them some ideas on riprapping and using a culvert if they had it to do the overflow. I don't know if they did it, but we tried to explain it to them.
Good. And I was thinking, what is your name?
Micah.
Is asking, and I'm not going to put you on the spot, but what would be your gift? Everyone, some people are out there, I think, really thinking they're changing the world. And some people do it in very quiet ways. And I think what you have to find out what you really have to offer, and I'm sure you do have things to offer, but discovering ways to make that effective for other people will be important for you.
I figure sometimes that this isn't just for, because you're young, but for any age, numbers changing the world kind of thing can paralyze. They can paralyze me. Mm-hmm. I work a little bit with the ELCA hunger appeal and the world hunger issues around the world. The estimate still is, for example, that there are about 800 million people in the world who are short of food. What's 800 million? That's hard to grasp, but I figured it out that if each of us standing in a line in a movie, if we allow just a foot and a half each, some of us can fit in, some of us can't, but if you have a foot and a half per person standing in a queue to get to a movie, 800 million people is 70 lines going from New York to LA. That's what 800 million is. And if you talk that number, you might as well pack it in. It's sort of no use. But if you can see sort of six of those people in that queue, in that line, who will die unless I can help, all right, pull them out of line and I'll help the six. I can't do the other. It's impossible, and I would be depressed and it's over. But sort of change the life of a few. That's about the only way I can keep sort of sanity when dealing with some of these global things. And one other follow-up as a way that seems to work when we think of sort of responsibilities, and that again, unfortunately, the Lutheran Church here is pretty good on this now overseas, even with the hunger money. It isn't sending our stuff to them, but it's helping them develop stuff on their own. And that's the long-term solution. And there are a couple examples we won't have time to go in, but if you can match up the people who have the economic agricultural know-how with the people of faith and ethics, match those people up in a country, lo and behold, pretty soon you're getting some good agricultural terraces and some soil conservation measures, and the tomato crop is doubled from what it was before. And people have been helped, not because we sent them something, but because we shared some knowledge.
Good. Maury.
I think another way of looking at that question is because we do get paralyzed so much by the scale, is it just to make a commitment to give. I think everything in our culture is proposing to us that we keep, that we get and we keep. And it's so easy to find that the purpose in life, to get and to keep. And if we keep reminding ourselves that our purpose in life is to give, we'll find plenty of opportunities. And we don't have to say which way of giving is going to save the world, because it's not the thing that we do, but the commitment to do it. That's part of our life, it becomes a part of our life, mm-hmm. to give. And I don't think you'll find there's any shortage of things to do, as long as you don't worry about, of these 12 options, which is for sure the best one. because none of them is going to save the world. If the world's going to be saved, it's God who's going to save it. But if we have a commitment to giving what we can, that's it frees us from that whole process of figuring out how much is enough to have and to hang on to.
Thank you.
I'd like to address Micah's too. The notion that it's so big, and I love the word, it paralyzes us, or it can energize us. And a concrete illustration that I see in our church where I come from, we started a group called Earth Care, and we're not out to change the world, but we've changed the way we do coffee. I mean, instead of throwing away cups, we wash them. We adopted a mile in the Mississippi, and I can tell you other things too, and if anybody wants to talk about it, I'd be eager to do it. But what's happened, and this is what we hoped would happen, is that these very small acts on our part created a consciousness within the group, and that consciousness has become big. And two of those people who belong to EarthCare have taken off for Iowa State Water Reservoir conferences, and one is a doctor and one's a teacher. They had nothing to do with that before, but now they do. And a couple have joined the Natural Resources Defense Council. They'd never even heard of it before. My point is only that starting out with small steps creates a kind of consciousness that makes bigger steps look possible, and then take those bigger steps. So the small step, you know, you all heard the story about the guy throwing out the starfishes, you know, that have been washed up on the shore. What good are you doing? There's a million of them. Well, help that one. And that creates a consciousness of bigger.
Yep, and there's a contagion about that. People give, they want to know what they're giving to and how they can improve that as well.
If your initial comments and the diversity are kind of rattling around, one of the things that occurs to me is that it's not just seeing the shadow side of our greatness, Ben, but that my perception of the diversity of our culture is we've got so many different ideas of what greatness is. And in some cases, some very superficial and conflicting ideas. If we aren't considering responsibilities, then I don't think we're talking about greatness in any category. Or, you know, involving subversive military strategies, maybe somebody says that's greatness. But we need to think critically about that. And I think the other thing about the diversity is that we struggle, I think, with a corporate ethos to agree about greatness. You know, to hold up something with some energy that says, this is really good and worthy and helpful for us because it is also for others. You know, the Utah example is classic. But, and these are all Americans. People in Utah and people in Arizona are. But there's still a very truncated notion of freedom and certainty of greatness.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of this, but I was just observing and thinking about it and talking to you. It's a very Western notion to think about results-based work. You know, to some degree, it's a question of humility. You know, it's up to God whether it works or not, or on what scale it does, but that we serve and that we do is because God calls us to do that. And the outcome's kind of up to Him.
Another way of putting that is that we're not called to make the world come out right, but to be faithful.
To be faithful. Chuck?
A woman was here a year or two ago that was a nurse in Los Angeles. She had 128 crack mothers, and between them they had 856 or such number of children, all basically non-productive. Now, I don't think we're going to have to worry about what our responsibilities, not my generation, I'm talking about young people now, with this bringing into the world a bunch of non-productive, basically, people, and then another at the other end. I think our responsibilities are going to come to us very rapidly.
You mean they may be forced on us?
There's a different set of problems coming than we've ever had in the United States.
I agree with you that there are. The children are going to raise, I think, huge issues for us. Not only the population you mentioned, but also the children who are growing up in not just poverty, but also danger. And how children react to danger. They can grow up in poverty and they can make it, but if they're always feeling in danger, there's a real sense of defensiveness and aggression there.
As I think about responsibilities being forced on us, though, it seems to me that this country has demonstrated an amazing ability to block those out. I mean, even the words that Norm read, you know, about equality for all people during written by slave owners. And as I think about these children growing up, I think about the people I see on the street now who are our responsibility, and we've abandoned them in so many ways. It's one of the things I like about the church is that I think that word keeps trying to break in on us and remind us of those responsibilities. We don't want to do that.
I come back to the fact that we're a country of immigrants, and bringing into the view that our new immigrants are very different from most of us in terms of our past. And what we owe them, and I like the idea of the reverse missionary, I think we really need to hear from them what they need. I'm reading that book, The Spirit Catches in You and You Fall Down, about a Hmong immigrant family in California. And I'm constantly pressuring myself not to be defensive about this, because I'm a physician and it really slams a lot of physicians. But what needed to happen in all of that was a dialogue. Simplistic, perhaps put, but that's what needed to happen, and that didn't happen. And I think that our immigrant population could probably teach us a lot about our responsibilities in the future, because they are wonderful in terms of child care. And we have not been stellar in terms of child care.
Yeah. I'm just curious, historically, if you think previous immigrant groups saw themselves as any less different.
Good point.
You know, when you read history, Lutherans and Catholics thought they were miles apart, very divergent, and even fellow Scandinavians, Norwegians and Swedes.
That's true.
And I think that's what culture is about. Language, custom, practice convinces us of that. We believe it when we encounter diversity. But I don't know that we believe it or fear it any more than other groups in history.
I have to think that our new immigrants mostly are immigrants of color. And I think that really puts a change on it, a little bit different. I agree with what you're saying in terms of the immigrants of the past. I've heard those stories, and I certainly believe them. I wasn't part of that, but I don't know.
I have to agree. When I resettled refugees in the early 80s, certainly there was a large influx of Indian Chinese. That was also when martial law went into effect in Poland. So we had a large group of Polish people coming into this country. It's the same time that the war was going on between Ethiopia and Eritrea. The same time that Fidel Castro was letting people out of Cuba. The war was really heating up in Afghanistan, so more people were fleeing out of Afghanistan than ever before. So we had a large influx of a variety of people coming into this country. And when I resettled them, the Polish people were the easiest people to find jobs for, not because they were better skilled, but because that they were Caucasian. I'm convinced of that. Mm-hmm. Some of the people that came in from other countries, like the first ones that came in from Afghanistan, were highly skilled pharmacists and physicians. I worked with the Minister of Education from Afghanistan. They had a tough time finding work. But the Poles, they slipped into jobs straight away.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a role, it strikes me there's a role for the church here, can really be valuable, and maybe not in the way that you expect, but in Iowa now, a lot of the Hispanic Americans are finding opportunities to work in the pork slaughtering and the beef slaughtering places, so it isn't just along the sort of Mex-America border. They're jumping up to Midwest and places that never had diversity. The geography colleague, Kurt Roseman, from he spends half the year in the Quad Cities, but he's former chair of the department at Southern California University. His specialty is studying immigrant groups. And he started to look at some of those communities in the Midwest, small communities, which now are facing diversity for the first time. And he's just beginning the study, but even in the preliminary study, he's finding in some communities the Hispanic population is more than welcome, mm-hmm. and they're brought into the... And in other communities, the barriers are there. And if you're wondering what I think the church has to do on this, my guess is, and well, partly guess, but part some experience, that they know that the pastor is going to be preaching for equality, and that the Cathys are going to be speaking for it, and perhaps even the cultural geographers, that those are going to be people calling for social justice. But we may not be the shakers and movers in town. The movers in town might be the physicians, the lawyers, the bankers, the business people. And I think the role, one important role of the church would be to get that segment in our memberships to take the unexpected positions of supporting minority rights and minority justice. For me, it's an environmental thing. I serve on a planning commission, and they know what I'm going to say. So it's almost like, okay, what's Norm going to say? But what really counts is when Ted and somebody else, that's the people's name that come to mind, these are the traditionally thought of movers and shakers in the community who take a position, we've got to do this. And it seems to me in some of these responsibilities, some of the people who have those traditional leadership roles in communities, for wherever right or wrong they are, those tend to still be the people that sort of cause things to happen. If they can take positions that can call attention to our collective community responsibility to welcome these in, terrific. And who are the people who can help do that? That, I think, is the church. I mean, all the members, but particularly the pastors, who can sort of let that message drift into the minds of the shakers and movers in a community.
Thank you. I'm going to say that we have about 4 minutes left, and then we're going to wrap it up and go to dinner. But let's keep going for 4 minutes. Yes, please.
I taught at an all-Native American school this year, and our director was a pretty highfalutin activist. She had started this school. She was the baby of the Indian people. We were talking about justice and like reconciliation and stuff like that. We would go back and forth because I really get into activism, and so does she. And so that was what we had in common. And at the end of one conversation one time, she just turned to me and she's like, "Can a country built on genocide ever be made right?" And I didn't know what to say to that. Like, she believed that it could, and I believed that it could. But at that moment, like, we were both just like, whew, you know? But by what she's done is she's sort of embraced the youth as the new way. And, like, I met so many kids this year that felt like they just didn't have any choices, they didn't have any options. That the world was like it was. They were poor, they were from the Praj, they were in the gang, like they were never gonna be out of the ghetto, and they just accepted that. And so to show, and I learned so much from them, and to show them that like there is a third way. Jesus talks about, like Walter Wink in his book, The Powers That Be, talks about this third way, and us thinking it either has to be like violence or passivity, you know, or this way or that way, but there's this third way that just is so unexplored. And so reaching out and showing our young people that it doesn't have to be the way it is, and empowering them and getting them to move forward, I think is like one of our greatest hopes for the future. And that you can reach into like globalization and try to tackle that, or race relations and try to tackle that, but really it's just like living with people in community and learning from each other, not thinking you're any better, and having these kids, whether they be from the ghetto or from the burbs, like there's a new way for all of us to like move forward together. And so Like, that's what she taught me by starting this school. Like, she had sort of like thrown her hands in at the White House. Like, she's been at the White House, she's been everywhere. And she just said, no, like, our future is here and it's us together. And so that was really hopeful for me, even like despite that question, and like for people that feel like they are forgotten, and that, you know, we talk about ourselves like as history starting with the Declaration of Independence, and like the kids just get so frustrated when they hear stuff like that. They're like, their fists just clench up. And so to like recognize that and like everybody move forward together, I think that that's really important. So.
Helping them understand that that applies to them as well. That
yeah.
Hope and independence.
Yeah.
Yes, Chuck.
I'm asking this question. Do you feel that the church has increased or decreased in its role as being the forum for advocating things in recent years?
Advocating what?
Well,
and what's the church?
Advocating just, yeah, not advocating the church, but advocating justice issues and
okay.
The responsibility.
So in terms of looking at responsibility to other people and justice issues, your question is the church advocating that at a higher level or lower level?
Right.
Good question. We've only got a minute and a half. What do you think? Judy?
Well, I'll say the discouraging word that I don't think we're getting better at it. Mm-hmm. And partly because I think we see that our numbers are dropping. And it's a lot less safe to take a stand. But we, you know, as Lutherans and others as well, we've never been out on the forefront anyway.
But the church, in terms of the broad Christian church, and some parts of it are becoming much more advocates. Now, we may not agree sometimes with what they're advocating, but and many of it is not justice issues. But so I think we also have to define what the church is. But I think you're right.
I was talking American church.
I think Judy's on something big about the scene in America with the decline. I think there's a great temptation for us to, you know, just embrace this American culture. I think abroad the church is doing better things. Just an image I had, I was in Egypt, all the women wearing veils, nobody looks at us. We walk into this one shop below ground to buy papyrus, and all the women look you right in the eye. No veils. And I said to the guy, Muslim guy, what's going on here? They are Christian. And they're a minority community there. And we're doing that in other parts of the world. I worry about this. Oh, we got to trump up our membership. We got to sell.
Well, the minority population, whether it's racial or religious, can be the spokesperson. They're the voice that needs to be heard.
So maybe if we become the remnant, we'll be back in
strength. Get it right.
Yeah, the other way to go with that, though, is if we deal effectively with issues of racism, we will have more people coming to our doors than. We can do it. So there's a direct connection between evangelism, growth, and racism. Because
on the other side of that, though, is if we really look at justice and we make a difference, people won't need to leave their countries to come here.
Well,
and
yeah, that's a big picture.
That's
right?
A huge thing. Well, you're all welcome to stay around and visit or go eat. See what you choose.